Hello, this is Search for Truth with the final talk in our series about objections to the gospel. Today's question is, what about all the bloodshed in the name of religion? I'm John Martin and it's a joy to welcome you to listen as Brian looks again into the scriptures and brings us the gospel's defence against this often voiced objection to what is after all God's good news to mankind. In 1859, Blondin, the great tightrope walker, took volunteers in a wheelbarrow across Niagara Falls. If I'd have been there, I could think of many objections against volunteering. And even if all those objections were fully satisfied, though, I would still have to step into the barrow. And so it is with the Christian faith. It's down to the individual to make his or her own decision, and all the preacher can do is to help toward it. And that's what Brian does again today. So, Brian, it's over to you.
Thanks, John. One of the popular comebacks when talking to people about the Christian faith is to hear people respond and say, "Oh, don't talk to me about religion. What about all the blood that's been shed in the name of religion?" Often they'll add, "There's been more blood shed in the name of religion than for any other reason." Often it's a tactic to close down the conversation. But let's at least take the challenge seriously. I wonder if the person who raises this objection has ever sat down and really tried to estimate the number killed by irreligion. I know how people in the West tend to throw up the example of the Spanish Inquisition, as serving as an example of religious horror, and that's perfectly understandable. We should point out that we're not in the business of defending it, not at all. But to put even that horror into perspective, what about comparing it with the scientific socialism of communist countries, which have killed 100 million around the globe? It's reckoned that Stalin alone may have been responsible for an estimated 30 million of those deaths. This is the Stalin who abandoned his seminary training and began to dogmatically deny the existence of God. But his daughter, Svetlana, has said that her father, when he was dying, sat up one final time from his deathbed and shook his fist at the ceiling. One has to wonder who he was shaking his fist at. But if we go back for a moment to the Inquisition, which in the course of three centuries killed perhaps 3,000 people, what we find, as we put even that horror into perspective, is that this was fewer people than the Soviet Union killed on an average day. There again, the scientific racism of Nazi Germany killed 40 million and attempted genocide against Europe's Jews. It's well enough documented that this was the outworking of anti-God ideas, the result of irreligious philosophies. The 19th century German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche had wanted to dismantle what he saw as the scaffolding effect of Christianity upon society. What Nietzsche wanted to do was to try an alternative foundation, a foundation for society without God. It was Nietzsche who popularised the statement, "God is dead," and dramatically portrayed it in his popular parable called The Madman, which goes like this. "Have you not heard of that madman who lit a lantern in the bright morning hours, ran to the marketplace and cried incessantly, 'I'm looking for God, I'm looking for God.' As many of those who did not believe in God were standing there, he excited considerable laughter. 'Why, did he get lost?' said one. 'Did he lose his way like a child?' said another. 'Or is he hiding? Is he afraid of us? Has he gone on a voyage or emigrated?' Thus they yelled and laughed. The madman sprang into their midst and pierced them with his glances. 'Whither is God?' he cried. 'I shall tell you. We have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers. God is dead, and we have killed him.'" What Nietzsche was talking about when he was talking about killing God was killing God philosophically. He'd little idea how costly this attempt would be in terms of human deaths. First of all, in his own life and health, because for the last dozen or so years of his life, he himself became the madman. Then along came his fellow countryman Hitler to put Nietzsche's ideas into practice and to build on them. The world soon learnt of the horrors that follow when we deconstruct the foundations of good thinking and begin to build instead on the basic idea that God is dead and life is senseless. Nietzsche, in the 19th century, actually forecast madness and violence in the 20th century based on the acceptance of his philosophy. This was fulfilled when Hitler gave copies of Nietzsche's work to Stalin and Mussolini. And when Hitler and Stalin built on these ideas, applying them to the fundamental values of society, disaster unfolded. As we say, Nazi Germany killed 40 million and communist countries killed 100 million, all in the name of irreligion. Those who claim more bloodshed has taken place in the name of religion than anything else seem to have forgotten the terrible lesson from these fearful social experiments of the 20th century. It's precisely these social experiments that support the Christian claim that the moral absolutes of the Bible are the best foundation for life. As Jesus said, "Therefore everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them may be compared to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against that house, and yet it didn't fall, for it had been founded on the rock. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against that house, and it fell, and great was its fall." By the way, we fully accept that religious bigotry is a horrible and cruel thing. There's no way we would wish to be thought of as defending it. After all, it was religious bigotry that put Christ on the cross. And actually, that now brings us to emphasise the difference between religion and faith. Religion is all about trying to do what we think we can do for God, whereas the essence of the Christian faith is all about what God has done for us in giving his own Son to die for our sins at the cross. Christianity is a living faith in a personal relationship with God through Jesus Christ. So we wouldn't be in the business of defending what's done in the name of religion in any case. On the contrary, we would make the case that a genuine experience of Christianity that's truly Bible-based is perceived today as not carrying the threat of violence, but rather being a force for peace in an increasingly violent world. In a public debate, the Oxford atheistic professor Jonathan Glover was asked, "If you, Professor Glover, were stranded at the midnight hour in a desolate Los Angeles street, and if, as you stepped out of your car with fear and trembling, you were suddenly to hear the weight of pounding footsteps behind you, and you turned and you saw 10 burly young men who had just stepped out of a dwelling coming towards you, would it or would it not make a difference to you to know that they were coming from a Bible study?" While the audience laughed, the professor admitted it would indeed make a difference. Of course, the same could not be said of all world religions today, but that's to come back to the clear distinction we're making between what's done in the name of some religion and what's consistent with true biblical Christian faith. Christianity has a proven track record of changing violent, bloodthirsty people into peace-loving citizens. One of the most gripping examples of a changed life which I've come across recently is the story of Stephen Lungu. He tells it in his book, Out of the Black Shadows. The Black Shadows being the gang he ran with in Zimbabwe back in the days in which it was called Rhodesia. Rejected by his father and abandoned by his mother when they split up, Stephen grew up with an angry and bitter heart. One night, he and his gang members decided to petrol bomb a mission tent where a preacher was addressing hundreds of people. He made the mistake of first stopping to listen for a few minutes. He describes in his book how the preacher jabbed with his pointed finger, "All have sinned. The wages of sin is death," adding, "Some here are not ready to die tonight." Stephen couldn't understand how this preacher already seemed to know about their plans to kill as many people as possible in that tent that night. The preacher went on to speak about how Jesus became poor, that we might become rich. Stephen could relate to poverty all right, and he quite fancied exchanging it for riches. So clutching his bag of petrol bombs, he was soon moving, almost involuntarily, to the front in a state of emotional and spiritual turmoil. The meeting was then interrupted when others started the petrol bomb attack, which Stephen had meant to lead. At that point, the preacher acknowledged Stephen. "Can your Jesus save someone like me?" Stephen asked. "Yes," came the reply, along with a request to share a bit of background information. As Stephen told of his rejection, the preacher himself began to cry. "Young man," he said, "I shall now tell you a story. Many years ago, there was a 14-year-old girl who became pregnant." He went on to tell how the father refused to take responsibility, so the girl dumped the baby in a toilet. But someone heard it drowning and rescued it, taking it to hospital. "I was that child," the preacher said. Stephen stared at him in astonishment. The preacher then read to him Psalm 27, verse 10. "Though my father and my mother forsake me, the Lord will take me up." Hearing that verse became the changing point in Stephen's life. "God," he cried, "I have nothing. I am nothing. I can't read. I can't write. My parents don't want me. Take me up, God. Take me up. I'm sorry for the bad things I've done. Jesus, forgive me and take me now." A throwaway child among the millions of Africa, but Jesus had found him and turned his life around. To this day, he tells others all across Africa and beyond of how God took him up. Well, thanks for your company as we've gone through these talks. I pray they'll be of some help under God in equipping us to answer our critics, so that in the power of God, they might be turned from their cynicism to a vibrant faith in Jesus Christ.
What kind of love is this that gave itself for me? I am the guilty one, yes, I go free. What kind of love is this? A love I've never known. I didn't even know his name. What kind of love is this?
What kind of love indeed? The Christian can say that the love that Jesus has for me is more than tongue can tell. That's all we have for today, and it's the end of this series. But if you like help with a question or want to make a comment, please get in touch. We are greatly encouraged by your emails. It's also your last chance to send for the free booklet. If you'd like one, ask for Overcoming Objections and write to Search for Truth, P.O. Box 111, Lee, spelt L-E-I-G-H, and the postcode is WN71WJ, England. If you're listening in Australia, write to Search for Truth, Box 748, Ringwood, Victoria 3134. Listeners in Africa, please write to Search for Truth, P.O. Box 70115, Chilomani, Blantyre, Malawi, or Search for Truth, P.O. Box 37, Surulere, Lagos State, Nigeria. Canadian listeners, write to Search for Truth, P.O. Box 28026, Brantford, Ontario, N3R7E0. Alternatively, you can email us. The address is sft@churchesofgod.info. And you may be interested to visit our website. You can find it at www.searchfortruth.org.uk. It's been a joy to have you share these things with us today, and if you've followed the series, I hope you found it helpful and interesting. Next time, we have the start of a new series, but till then, our very best wishes from Brian, our studio technician David Shaw, our singers, and me, John Martin. May God richly bless you wherever you are.